May I know good people and follow in their footsteps. That's a nice prayer, a good motto. Know good people and follow in their footsteps. Of course, it begs the question, who are good people? Aristippus has his list, people who are the friends to that which abides, people who never rejoice in the ill fortune of others, people who are faithful to friends. Seems like a good list, but it's not quite that simple, is it? What one person sees as good, another person often sees as evil. Is goodness to be found in purity, in shunning transgressors, in being upright and proper? Many think so. But others think that goodness is to be found in honesty, in living with joy, in accepting strangers as friends, in radical forgiveness and risk-taking. Is the soldier who displays honor and bravery good? Many think so. Others think, no, we ought not to praise such violence, that real bravery would be refusing to fight, and if everyone was so brave, there would be no more war, and that would be good. Is the child who sits still, listens to her elders, is seen but not heard, cleans his room every day, is this the good child? Or is the good child the one who is insatiably curious, finds her own path, speaks up, and gets dirty, having fun every day? These are not easy questions. They can be emotional questions. They touch our sense of identity, our way of life, our loyalties, our hopes and fears. The theme for the month of June is good and evil. Over the next 4 weeks, we'll explore this theme. It isn't a series. Each sermon stands on its own. I know people travel during the summer. So today I want to talk about the very idea of good and evil. Try to get at how we decide what's good and evil, how we judge these things. Later this month, I want to talk about the problem of evil, the question that Susan posed in her chalice lighting, why is there evil in the world? Another Sunday will be about the how-to. How do we do good? How do we overcome our hesitations and addictions? And then when I'm in Phoenix for the annual national meeting of Unitarian Universalists, Stanley Campbell is going to do a case study for you, Good and Evil in the City. That should be fun, right? So what is good and evil anyway? These are not easy questions. They can be emotional about identity and loyalty. They're not easy questions, but they surely are human questions. At some point in our evolution, we developed a sense of conscience, a sense that some things are wrong and some are right, and that we should avoid the wrong and do the right. It seemed evolutionarily helpful, made it easier to live in community with others and increased survival odds. Maybe conscience arose at the same time as consciousness. When we became self-aware, we started to think about good and evil, develop the capacity to do evil and to do good. We don't know the minds of animals. We might grant with the poet that the rattlesnake approves of himself without reservation, and that the killer whale's heart weighs 100 kilos, but in other respects it is light. We might agree with that. But some primates seem to have a sense of moral action, too. There are cruel behaviors which cause members of the tribe to be cast out. They've gone too far. And kind behaviors which are rewarded with affection. Do they think good and evil? Or do they instead experience pleasure and pain, and we are just anthropomorphizing? Which, of course, really begs the question right back. Is there really good and evil? Or are those just words that we give to pleasure and pain? Are they self-justifications for our desires, ex post facto descriptions of what we would have done anyway? Or in a Nietzschean fashion, are good and evil simply inventions of the powerful, systems of social control used to keep power in the hands of the few? Is there such a thing as good and evil per se? This is a deeply human question, and all deeply human questions have been deeply religious questions. In the West, religion has typically said, yes, there is good and there is evil. Good is God's will and evil is Satan's will, or good is godlike and evil is earthly. Good is to follow these rules. There are 613 of them, or there are 10 of them, or however it is. Religion in the West has often said, sure, we know what's good and what's evil, and we'd be happy to tell you and to judge you based on your compliance with our definition. In the East, this is less true. The Taoists see good and evil as just names, and Buddhists are quick to remind you not to be quite so attached to such things. And yet, it is still good to follow Tao or to practice compassion. So whether East or West, religion is often about a better way to live, about identifying what is worthy of praise and why you should be good and what good is. But religions are never monolithic. Folks who take a more liberal approach within the religious world have long asked interrogative questions about the religious understanding of good and evil. Is it true? Does it make sense? Some of the old rules seem silly. But if some rules are silly, do we throw all the rules out? If you think it's silly that you can't mix fibers or are commanded to stone adulterers, then is it also silly to prohibit theft? Is it silly to say you should love your neighbor? If the religious understanding of good and evil seems arbitrary, and I suspect it does to many of us, then where do we turn? As the first reading mentioned, there are lots of kinds of ethicists. Here is the Nickel Tour. This could be a whole semester course in moral philosophy. You're going to get about 2 minutes. Okay. Start with Socrates. After a long conversation with a fellow named Phaedrus about what was good and evil, Socrates prays. And the words from the introit this morning came from this prayer. Socrates prays, "Beloved Pan and all ye other gods who haunt this place, give me beauty in the inward soul, and may the outward and the inward man be at one. May I reckon the wise to be the wealthy, and may I have such quantity of gold as a temperate man and he only can bear and carry." That's nice, isn't it? That's a nice prayer. What is good for Socrates is that the outward and the inward be at one, that we know ourselves, be true to ourselves, especially to our inner voice, the true conscience. And we still, all these thousands of years later, still judge hypocrisy to be unworthy. And we praise those who follow their conscience. Even if we disagree with people, we respect those who are inward and outward one. Aristotle, two generations later, says, but wait, we can't really judge a person's interior motivations or test whether or not their inward and outward life is the same. We don't know their inward life. So instead, we should judge good and evil by determining whether the action taken displayed virtue or vice. Virtuous actions hit the sweet spot. It is the right response at the right time. Courage instead of cowardice on one end or rashness on the other, the right response. You determine if someone has displayed virtue or vice by telling their story. Who acted? With whom? What was the situation? What choice did they make? In what way did they make it? What did they intend, and what happened after they did their action? When you tell the whole story, then you can judge the whole story. Did they do good or middling, or did they do evil? This approach is still helpful, especially the part about telling the whole story. So we might have some empathy for the moral choices of others. It's easy to judge from a distance. It's a lot harder up close when we see the complex constraints and reality of an ethical issue. Aristotle's approach held sway for a long time until the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment and the British Empire builders felt like this storytelling approach was too vague. They wanted something more objective and concrete. So they created an approach we call utilitarianism or consequentialism. It's simple. Do the greatest good for the greatest number. You still have to define the good, of course, and you get hedonistic answers, the greatest pleasure and the least pain for the greatest number, as well as more substantive answers, where the greatest number of people flourish, or where the greatest number of people have freedom, or the greatest number of people have some standard of wealth. The sense, though, is that you can measure this, and then you can judge it. It's an optimistic approach, really, and a modernist approach, and one well-suited to colonialists who are in the habit of making decisions for large groups of other people. The problems with the utilitarian approach are many, but there's one thing I really like about it: the focus on the consequences of our actions. You hear a lot of folks today talk about good intentions. Well, I didn't mean to hurt you, so I didn't do a bad thing. As if evil only happened when we meant it. Please. Others do not experience what is in our heart. They experience what happens to them. And consequences matter. And we should ask about how what we will do will affect others when we decide whether it's good or evil. Meanwhile, other Enlightenment folks wanted a way to decide good and evil based on pure reason. We can think it out through our heads, they thought. And Kant came up with what's called the categorical imperative. Some of you may have learned it at some point in your education. Act according to the maxim that you would wish all other rational people to follow, as if it were a universal law. It's slightly different than the golden rule, but similar. Basically, it is do what you wish everyone would do if they were in the same position. Elsewhere, Kant puts it this way: always treat people as ends in themselves and not as a means to another end. And that remains a good rule to this day, one too often followed in the breach, as we see others not as people, but as cogs in the machine, as competitors, as objects, or we just don't see them at all. The Unitarian Universalist commitment to what we call the inherent worth and dignity of every person grows directly out of this Kantian Enlightenment sense of the importance of treating people as people. Why this nickel tour of good and evil? To show that good and evil are not simple. Judging them is not simple. Smart people use different ways to decide and describe what is the right thing to do and what is the wrong thing to do. Each of these methods have something to recommend them. It's good to follow your conscience. It's good to be virtuous. It's good to assess the consequences. It's good to treat other people as people and not objects. Though each of these methods have useful parts, none of them will tell us exactly what to do in every ethical dilemma. None of them will really answer the question, what is good and what is evil? All these theories can help, but often they run up against each other. Often our ethical choices involve conflicting goods. One action would display the virtue of courage, but the vice of intemperance. So what do we do? Or following our universal maxim, doing what we think everyone should do, means that someone else is going to get hurt. Or we have to be inconsistent to be kind. Do you tell a little lie to avoid a great pain? What if forgiveness puts people at risk? What if you think the risk is small, but what if you're wrong? These hard ethical choices are hard because the models, they break down when they're pushed hard enough. The models help us ask the right questions. They make us go beyond our instincts, but our gut level or traditional answers. They can be helpful, but the models aren't enough. So what's the answer? What's the secret formula for deciding what to do, for judging good and evil? There isn't one. Maybe that's not what you expect your minister to say, but it's the truth. For 3,000 plus years, folks have given answers, religious and philosophical, biological and sociological. The answers are helpful, but no one of them is complete. Everyone is just a model. There's no secret. What's good and evil? There's no system, no absolute. Yet we have a conscience, and we are in community together, so we can think and talk and see and do together and adjust and discuss, make provisional decisions together. I don't know about you, but when I find that I'm having a hard time deciding between what's good and what's evil and judging what I should do or what others might do, I do really well to ask someone else what they think. A colleague, my wife, a friend, or a read from a few experts in the field. Maybe I'll wind up agreeing with the person I've asked, or maybe disagreeing with them, but I'll be wiser for it. My sense of good and evil will be better. And that process itself, I submit to you, is good. Conversation, learning, discovery. This is good, and it leads to the good, and it is in itself admirable. What is good and evil? There's no system, no absolute. But generally speaking, the search for the good is the search for what is beautiful, what is pleasing to the conscience and to life. Miss Rumphia searches her whole life to figure out what she can do to make the world more beautiful. The search itself is good, and so is what she discovers by accident that she can do. Socrates said that the soul's beauty is to follow conscience, and Aristotle that the virtuous act is beautiful, pleasing to the senses. Near the end of his career, Kant seemed to suggest that it was not, after all, in pure reason, but in the faculty of taste, of aesthetic judgment, that we distinguish between good and evil. More recently, the Unitarian Universalist ethicist Sharon Welch wrote that aesthetics is a key component of ethics. At critical junctures, she continues, in shaping our responses to both the challenges of interpersonal decency and systemic injustice, it is as much a matter of style as it is of courage to act well, to act honorably. The choir this morning sang these words from Dana Greeley, the first president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. Let all the beauty we have known illuminate our hearts and minds. And this is how we know, I think, between good and evil. We can and should use all these models to ask questions, to get under our assumptions, but then we return to this sense of beauty, that what is good is beautiful, and it makes the world more beautiful. And what is evil is all that denies the beauty we have found. And I mean, of course, beauty, not glamour. Beauty comes from a sense of harmony, a sense of care, a spirit of love that is present in what we do and how we experience things. Beauty makes us pay attention. Good makes us look with admiration. Where evil, or that which is like what is ugly, makes us usually turn away, unless by conscience compelled, we feel we must change it, must repair the breach and restore what is broken, heal the wounds or speak out against what is wrong. Like all things that matter, there are here no easy answers. Some might throw up their hands, just pick one model for the sake of simplicity, or none at all, which seems to be a common choice. We are called to another path, the path of community, discovering together, the path of the search for the truth and right ever open to new insight, the path of love, seeking to widen and include, the path of justice, seeking to repair and renew, the path of beauty, calling us with joy to the life of goodness. I invite you to rise in body or in spirit. We're going to sing together hymn number 108 in your gray hymnal, My Life Flows On in Endless Song.